Thanks for inviting me into your home. Long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi. Your parents' well-appointed rec room with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker. Your loft. That greasy spoon just off the interstate and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight this morning we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto affiliate, News Talk 1010. I hope you enjoyed last night's transmission as much as I did. I'm still crawling out from under all the emails and tweets I received in response to our discussion on flat earth theory with Rob Skiba. It was a mixed bag. I received one tweet from a listener who claimed he was reporting me to the CRTC. That's Canada's version of the FCC. He wanted me pulled off the air. But then in a subsequent tweet from this same gentleman, he congratulated me on my choice of bumper music. So go figure. There was a lot of emails and tweets from people who enjoyed the program, but they're not buying flat earth theory for a second. However, they indicated they appreciated the program nonetheless. One tweet expressed utter dismay that Coast to Coast would entertain such nonsense, he wrote, something to the effect that the world is a lot dumber today, thanks to me. And many of you wrote in offering counter-arguments from both camps, either arguing against the spherical skeptics or the globists. Not the globalists, but the globists. I wonder if the spherical skeptics believe globists are, in fact, globalists. In any event, I thought it was an interesting and lively discussion, and most importantly, nobody got hurt. I can't wait for your response to tonight's first half. Almost 4 years ago, I introduced Ambassador Lee Wanta to the Coast audience. Lee has a number of different handles: President Reagan's secret agent, the $32 trillion man, although that figure keeps rising due to the miracle of compound interest. I think when I first met Lee Wanta, he was the $20 trillion man. Lee has an incredible story. In a nutshell, he was deputized by President Reagan to end the Cold War by collapsing the Soviet economy, which he supposedly did through a series of currency swaps and other financial maneuvers. So he ended the Cold War without firing a shot, amassing an unimaginable fortune in the process. A portion of that money, according to the terms of the Reagan-Mitterrand protocols, was to be used to pay off the U.S.'s national debt. The only problem is, a whole cast of bad actors inside and outside government have been trying to get their hands on Lee's fortune and have subjected him to false imprisonment and a massive smear campaign that has gone on for decades. Ambassador Lee Wanta and his communications director, Lon Gibby, will be here shortly and for the first 2 hours with this remarkable tale, seemingly lifted out of the pages of an Ian Fleming novel. Now, from Ian Fleming to Irwin Allen, how many of you remember this TV show? That's it. That's The Time Tunnel, which ran for one season, 30 episodes, back in 1966, 1967, starring James Darren and Robert Colbert, Lee Merriweather. It aired on ABC and was created by Irwin Allen. Gosh, that takes me back. Or forward. That's the trouble with time travel. You can never remember. That's for you, Doctor Who fans. Now, my guest in hour 3 and 4 is the author of a series of time tunnel books. Two published, in fact, a third is in the works. They're works of fiction, techno-thrillers, I guess is the genre. They'd also belong to the what-if genre. What if we had the technology, a time machine or time tunnel, that would allow someone to go back and, let's say, prevent 9/11? That's always an interesting discussion, to try and imagine what would happen if we could travel back and undo some wrong, or prevent a Hitler from coming to power, or prevent Mark David Chapman from murdering John Lennon. Richard Todd is the author of Time Tunnel, The Twin Towers, and Time Tunnel, The Empire. They're not only gripping thrillers, but Todd is also an inventor with 4 patents in the field of information technology, and he weaves real science into these books. So we'll talk about the future of time travel, and also we'll try and imagine how changing the outcomes of various historical events could change our present timeline. Does time travel have a future? That's hours 3 and 4. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Lon Gibby is the president of Gibby Media Group, Inc., a full-service multimedia and advertising company with decades of experience. Since 1983, GMG has produced more than 4,000 videos ranging from television, commercials to training videos, feature-length documentaries to corporate videos, and just about everything in between. Gibby's latest film is the documentary Eagle One Tawanta, which chronicles President Reagan's secret agent, Ambassador Lee Emile Wanta, who helped mastermind a creative way to financially take down the economy of the Soviet Union and negotiated an agreement with Secretary General Mikhail Gorbachev. Lon Gibby, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
Great, Richard. Awesome to be with you tonight.
We should also point out you are the communications director for Lee Wanta, who at this moment is... Well, we're going to introduce him a little bit later. You're going to lay a bit of the groundwork for us. It's been about 4 years. It'll be 4 years in May since you were last on the program, and there are a lot of people probably listening now who didn't hear that program. So let's again, lay the just give us the backstory. First of all, I described a little bit of Lee's background, appointed by President Reagan under a particular doctrine. And he became his secret agent. First of all, I never knew there was such a thing. Take me back, to how that happened. Why did President Reagan choose this rather unassuming gentleman to become a secret agent?
Well, that's a great. That's such an interesting story. It's been what I call obstructed history. There's so much of this story that you're going to hear tonight that has never been told to the American public. It's been suppressed and covered up. But anyway, to tell you about Ambassador Lee Wanta, first of all, President Reagan needed somebody that he could trust that that would be willing to do some work behind enemy lines. And he used what was called the Totten Doctrine, which was initiated by President Abraham Lincoln with a man named Totten, that was used to help go behind the Confederate lines to help bring down the Confederacy. He used the Totten Doctrine to justify bringing on board a person that he trusted. His name was Lee Emile Wanta, also known as Leo Emile Wanta, and he... I became an ambassador, by the way, in this process, an official ambassador, and we'll talk about that later. But anyway, Lee was commissioned or mandated to do some work behind the enemy lines to help bring down the Soviet Union, or what was known as the Evil Empire. And if you go back in history, of course, a lot of the history isn't being taught about that time period right now, but if you go back, that was a very, very scary time in our history, in our country. It was just one button away, from a nuclear disaster that could have wiped out, mankind on the earth. So it was very serious. Plus, we had an arms race that was absolutely blown out our economy. We were having to keep up with and build our military might up, and it was a tremendous drain on our economy.
Sure. So plus, dozens and dozens of horrible proxy wars going on in Africa, in Southeast Asia, all over the place. People think that it was a non-shooting war. And while the United States and the Soviet Union didn't necessarily exchange a lot of gunfire, all these proxy wars around the world were killing and maiming tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people.
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of people didn't realize that China was struggling against the evil empire as well. During that time period, there was border skirmishes going on. There was a potential war between Russia and China that was in the process of taking place. So Reagan decided to work in conjunction with the Chinese and at the premier at the time, Deng Xiaoping, and he also had a counterpart that was became Lee's partner. His name was Howie Kwok. And the two worked together to effect currency changes that would help take down the Soviet Union financially as opposed to taking them on in a shooting war.
So
Lee was
so,
responsible for that.
So this currency exchange, this was the instrument by which he collapsed the Soviet economy, and we can get Lee in here later maybe to give us a few more details. But he was first, however, Lee was given some seed money, right, in order some money to play with in order to do this. Where did that money come from?
That money was basically needed to just be backed up. They were able to receive some credit through working with the Chinese. Lee was able to, and President Reagan, they worked together on this. They got Lee received about $150 billion in seed money, which was what they and which was backed up, you know, with the help of the Chinese.
$150 billion with a B. $150 billion.
That is correct.
And this is in the $150 billion. This is in the 1980s, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So through this currency exchanges, and Lee can tell you more details how he did it. But you know, remember Lee not only was he somebody that Reagan trusted, but he had a photographic memory, understood mathematics very well, and was just very brilliant. I don't know what Lee's IQ is. He'll probably he would be embarrassed that if you ask him that. But I can tell you that he's brilliant enough that, plus, besides being brilliant, he had the character and the integrity that Reagan trusted him. And a lot of people know who Lee is in the White House. They saw him come and go. And those people, you know, of course, some of them are still alive and
right.
are part of the project that we're working on the documentary.
So when we say that Lee was a secret agent, he's not like a James Bond character who was carrying a gun or, you know, had a cyanide pill around his neck in case he got caught. He wasn't that kind of a secret agent, right?
No, well, there was a lot of things that happened similar to that, but the problem is, if he was a spy, he wouldn't have lived. There's no way that he could have done the work he did. He had to be able to go behind enemy lines, in other words, work with the enemy and get their trust. And he was able to do some things that a spy or somebody that would be considered an employee of the government wouldn't have been able to do.
All right. Lon Gibby is with us, and he is the president of Gibby Media Group. He also acts as Ambassador Lee Wanta's communications director. He's also, Lon is a documentary filmmaker. We'll tell you a little bit about Eagle One to Wanta. That's the documentary film that has been in the works for, what, 3-4 years? And
It's been about almost 5 years now.
All right. And also the editor of Lee Wanta's incredible story. It's called Wanta, Black Swan, White Hat. And Ambassador Lee Wanta is in a secure location tonight. He's we can't divulge where he is, but he will join us after the bottom of the hour. Now, so these, and he'll describe this in more detail, but these currency exchanges that essentially were what they accomplished was devaluing the Russian ruble. The ruble collapsed, and so the Soviet Union was basically broke. They couldn't keep up with the U.S. Arms race and the spending and the military spending of the United States. So I understand then Wanta convinced Mikhail Gorbachev basically to step aside, and he paid him $10 billion. Is that correct?
That's correct, and that's part of the documentary and the story, and it's in Lee's biography. He actually went into the Kremlin and was able to set up the meetings that with Gorbachev and did give him $10 billion to step down. And Gorbachev agreed that was the amount that he agreed to step down. He was paid those funds, and then he moved to Presidio, California, started his foundation, the Gorbachev Foundation. So that's a part of the history that nobody really has heard about. or really understands. But I could tell you, after 5 years of researching it and looking at all the documents and interviewing quite a few people, I could tell you that I believe without question that that is the truth of exactly what happened, the way that we're describing it.
But when you first were approached by Lee, or when you first met him, on the face of it, I mean, it sounds too incredible to be true. Did you believe it right away?
Well, when I first heard he was known as the $27 trillion man, I'm like most people, when they hear that, they roll their eyes or they start thinking, yeah, right, you know. But when I started learning about him, and he did come to my studio in Washington State and spent a week and lived in our home, actually, for a period of time. Everyone said he would never come, and he did. He showed up, and we picked him up. There were some security issues at the time. But we spent a whole week together and interviewed him. I have 13 hours of content from Lee where his mind is very sharp. I mean, even at that time, he was 75. He could recount details, times, dates, people's names. And he's 79 now. He can still do the same. You'll get to hear from him here a little later in the broadcast. You'll be surprised at just how sharp he is at his age. And, you know, of course, he's up late at night, just like all of us, up here at 1 o'clock in the morning for him.
Right.
So you'll be impressed, I think, when you hear Lee.
So when we refer to him as the $31.2 trillion, I'm rounding it up to $32 trillion. What's a trillion between friends, right? But the $32 trillion man. So that is the fortune that he amassed, not only through these currency exchanges, but there were some other financial maneuvers that he did. And again, he'll explain. He's buying certain, bank promissory notes or something. But this money that he made, what was he supposed to do with that money according to President Reagan?
Well, that's the exciting thing, the positive thing that, you know, I wanted to share with your listeners, is that other than a lot of people would say, oh, he's going to get rich and have all this money, just want, like, winning the lottery or something, his whole plan was to do what Reagan had mandated or asked him to do. He took an oath, Lee did, to follow the mandate that Reagan had set up, and that was that when they amassed all this money, the plan was to repatriate it. It was made outside the country, in Austria, where they had some corporations set up specifically for this application. And the whole idea.
Your line is breaking up, Lon. I'm not sure. Are you on a cell phone or a cordless phone?
Okay. How's that? Is that better?
That's better. Okay. So just back up about 20 seconds there.
So let me back up and say that he. Ask me that question once again, if you would, please.
All right. So what was to be done with this $32 trillion that Wanta had amassed using these currency exchanges and other financial maneuvers?
All right. Here's the exciting thing about it for every American and the whole world. That the money was supposed to basically be repatriated back into the United States. It was made outside of the United States. In Austria, it was made under a private corporation. But Lee had agreed with Reagan that money would be repatriated and so that he could pay his taxes into our country. And part of it was to build, pay taxes, which, again, a substantial amount at 35% would go in, and which would pay off our national debt. The other thing that it was supposed to be used for was for a high-speed rail system and infrastructure for our country, to get us caught up, and also go into helping with some of the banking issues, you know, some of the corrupt banking that's going on. They wanted to develop a better student loan program where students aren't ripped off. They wanted to also help the veterans.
Okay, so by paying the tax on when he repatriates the trillions into the United States, he has to pay tax on that. 35%, right. That we're talking, what, $12, $13 trillion, that would go to pay off part of the debt and then, you know, help build infrastructure. We're going to bring the man himself into the conversation in just a moment. Lon Gibbey, my guest from Gibbey Media Group. He is the communications director for Ambassador Lee Wanta, President Reagan's secret agent, the $31.2 trillion man, and he joins us next. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-double-T. Get on up to the coasttocoastam.com website. Interesting story there in the news section. One of Britain's strangest UFO cases involving a high-speed police chase, which occurred on the morning of October 24th, 1967. PCs Roger Willie and Clifford Waycott had been on routine patrol along the A3072 between Hatherley and Holsworthy when they encountered a large, bright, cross-shaped object hovering in the sky nearby. Perplexed, they attempted to approach the object and managed to get within 400 meters of it before it started moving away. They noted that it seemed to be aware of their presence. After reporting it to the station, they decided to set off in pursuit. The chase would see them reach speeds of up to 90 miles per hour on the county's roads. However, they were ultimately unable to apprehend it. A holidaymaker, Christopher Garner, later confirmed that he had also witnessed the spectacle. It was definitely there and definitely either manned by some sort of being or remotely controlled, said PC Willie. It was definitely being controlled to view our car. Again, you can read the rest of that story in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. When we return, the $32 trillion man, Ambassador Lee Wanta, Ronald Reagan's secret agent, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast Toronto, Canada affiliate, in-depth radio news talk 1010. Earlier, we introduced you to Lon Gibby. Right now, we'll bring in the man himself. Ambassador Lee Wanta was President Reagan's secret agent who masterminded a creative way to financially take down the economy of the Soviet Union and put together and negotiated an agreement with Secretary General Mikhail Gorbachev. As a result, the Russian Federation was born, and future generations throughout the entire world have enjoyed more safety from a nuclear holocaust because of this effort. In the process, Lee Wanta amassed trillions of dollars that were designated to go back to the American people by President Reagan. In his effort to carry out this mandate, Lee was imprisoned, and the monetary funds that were his to distribute as planned were stolen or converted illegally by an organization known as the Federal Reserve System and used by them to this day. And, of course, his story is told in his biography, Wanta, Black Swan, White Hat. Ambassador Lee Wanta, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you, sir? Do we have Lee there? Ambassador Wanta.
Lee, can you unmute your phone there, Lee, and join us?
Do we have him?
Sure.
Ambassador Wanta.
There he is. We got him.
All right.
Oh, you got it.
Terrific. Thank you for joining us. Now, I'm not going to ask you to
join all for all fellow Americans, good evening.
I'm not going to ask you to divulge your exact location, but are you able to give us a clue? Are you in the continental United States?
Absolutely.
You are. Okay. And is your life in danger?
Well, they think I is, but I'm Catholic. I don't care what they think.
All right. You're protected by a higher being. Let me ask
Absolutely.
You... Just to give us the Reader's Digest version, and we've talked a little bit about it in your absence, Lon Gibby and I, how does one amass trillions of dollars in such a seemingly short time? Just give us a very brief kind of overview, not too complicated, of how that's done.
Well, the biggest thing you have to do, you have to go out of the country, because if you work within the United States proper, it would be an act of war. And I thought President Reagan wanted me to go to Paris, and I ended up in Vienna, Austria. And that was quite embarrassing, because I arrived at 4:30 in the morning, and I had no idea what I was doing in Austria. And they called it WIN, Vienna, and I didn't know Austria. I was thought I was going to Paris, because they knew I took high school French. Big deal on that. But the thing went, we had to work it out. And what we did, we opened accounts at a number of banks around the world, and we started to trade the rubles. The rubles were worth $1.20, they say. And we had accounts at the Bank of China, which was very much concerned about the border invasions all the time, or excursions where Chinese people were getting killed and President Reagan had me meet Deng Xiaoping, the paramount leader in Western Hills in Peking. And I enjoyed the visit because he told me at the same time that when George Bush was there as a representative of the United States, he was a perfect idiot. He would ask him all kinds of questions, and he would turn around and ask his staff what was the answer. And he got to the point that he excused everybody, because if he had to talk to his assistants, he would rather do that than be stared at by George Bush's real name and shirt. And he wasn't even allowed to be the president. And he was doing his job as a representative of Uncle Sam. And nobody would trust him because he wasn't very smart.
Okay, but if we could get back to how you were able to amass these trillions using these currency exchanges. So you were buying back the ruble, I guess, what, on pennies on the dollar, sort of?
No, we weren't allowed to buy. We were exchanging. The law says we can exchange currency, and that's what we were doing. And we met with Ambassador Tyshenko and Bushka from the Central Bank of the Soviet Union, Howie and I, my partner, and they said they would not give us $1.20, even though I was the benchmark between the banks. So we danced and argued back and forth, and I said, I'm not going back. How much are you going to give me? He says, well, I'm not going to give you anything. I said, well, I have all these rubles. So we finally danced around my deal, Carnegie, to skip with the powers to be, which is Ambassador Tyshenko of the Soviet Union in Singapore, and everybody else. And we agreed it was going to be 80 cents. Now, 80 cents versus $1.20 are really going to be ripped off. But the problem is we had accounts, and if we could get the rubles, and we were buying rubles, or we were exchanging rubles. They were getting the rubles for 22 cents a piece, 40 cents a piece, 80 cents a piece. No, but we would take them if we had to. But most of the time, we were getting from between 22, 40 cents, 45 cents per ruble. So we had all those rubles coming in through Credit Scott Bank and other banks, and also in China, rather in Singapore, we had tremendous amount. And we established from the Prime Minister of Singapore, he was now duly elected, so he could not own a Nickel Credit Pte. Limited in Singapore. So Howie and I had a chance to buy. He bought the Prime Minister's shares, and I bought his wife's shares. So we also suddenly own a Nickel Credit Pte., which was now consultant to banks and counsel to banks. So now we have all the banks working under a Nickel Credit Pte. Limited that Howie and I own 50-50. And Howie got the money from his father, who was a warlord in China. And that took care of that problem real quick because I had cash. I had $150 billion because I was the director general of New Republic USA Austria. Financial group in Austria, and that's why if you think about how Reagan set the thing up, New Republic USA, New Republic United States of America.
Right. Financial so who gave you the $150 billion to start the operation?
The Bank of China.
Ah, okay.
Because I met Deng Xiaoping a few times. He trusted me.
Got it.
And then they had Howie be my bodyguard, and he was the warlord's son. So it worked out slick. They trusted Howie. I trusted Howie. And,
okay.
I learned a heck of a lot.
These currency exchanges, did the Soviets realize what you were doing, that you were trying to collapse their economy? Did they have a clue?
They didn't know about that. All they thought we were idiots because we were taking over the rubles that nobody wanted. And if they had the rubles, they couldn't buy anything with the rubles because they needed hard currency. We knew that, and the Soviets weren't going to talk about it because they thought they could keep all those rubles all secure under their own control. But nobody would buy anything with the rubles because most of the people were buying stuff in Hungary, and they didn't want any more rubles because they had a tough time converting that to something better than a ruble.
Okay, so they
picked up all the rubles.
Right. So this had the effect of basically collapsing the ruble. Is that right?
Well, yeah, we collapsed the ruble and the Soviet Union because they had all these rubles not coming back, and they didn't know what to do. And then we started sending the rubles back to Bank of China, and they were demanding $1.20, even though we only got 80 cents. We put them in there, but the Bank of China had a big office in Singapore, and we own a nickel credit. So it worked out slick that we got tremendous. We had billions and billions of rubles at a very good pricing.
And then, so how did you parlay that into the $31.2 trillion? Very, very quickly, if you could. Just give us a quick
taste. We invested hard currency into prime bank guarantees, which means we could buy prime bank guarantees at 30, 40, 50 cents on the dollar, and we would tell them to keep these bank guarantees there. We would take the cash and reinvest it somewhere else because we told them in a couple of years if we don't come back, forget about it. And they were happy with that deal because prime bank guarantees, if they were real and you could get them from the main major top 10 banks, people would help us. And we did trillions of dollars in prime bank guarantees because they had promissory bank notes that the banks were trying to front, and they were worthless. They promised to pay, big deal, like the Federal Reserve promises to pay you. That's a promise. It's not a collection.
Right.
And that's why we had the prime bank guarantees, which produced a lot of cash.
And this money, you and your partner, Howie Kwok, you squirreled this away in banks all over the world. Is that the idea?
Every place we could go, the banks loved us. They thought we were bringing in cool cash, real cash, and it wasn't scrap paper.
And so at a certain point then, mission accomplished. You've paid off Gorbachev $10 billion. He retires to California. The Russian Federation is born. The Soviet Union, the evil empire, has collapsed. Now you're ready at this point to bring the money back to the United States. Is that the idea?
Sorry, I sent the first test tranche for $4.5 trillion. We had $27.5 trillion at that time. So we did a test tranche to the Bank of America through a corporation I set up so we could do all the stuff to rebuild our country called Ameritrust Group, Inc. in Richmond, Virginia. So they accepted the first $4.5 trillion as a starter from us, and that was in Richmond, Virginia, with the Commonwealth. And I signed all the papers. I own 100% of Ameritrust Group, Inc., and even Judge Lee and Judge Ellis ruled of the U.S. federal courts in Virginia. I'm the total owner and responsible for all that money, and they allowed me to send that money in to Ameritrust Group, Inc. at the Bank of America. But then this guy Paulson, the Secretary of Treasury, he comes out of nowhere, and he talks to people in Congress, and they make a deal amongst themselves. Well, Wanta can't have that money. Ameritrust can't have that money. So they were going to allow me to do whatever they wanted if I would play ball with them. So I sent $4.5 trillion into the Bank of America for Ameritrust Group, Inc. And suddenly, Henry Paulson and his other goon squad, they decided that I'm not entitled to $4.5 trillion, so they converted the money. They didn't steal the money. They came a new word. They're going to convert the money from me to them. So Bank of America froze on it, and they had money into Wells Fargo as well. And just in the first of the 27.5, I only sent 4.5 to test tranche because they converted that money, and I had to go in front of the federal courts, Judge Lee and Judge Ellis, and they agreed with me, it's my money. And the money came from New Republic USA Financial Group. We didn't do any transactions in the United States. That would be an act of war. And that's why I became a resident. I had an office in Vienna, Austria. We had Credit Suisse Bank. We had everybody. We had every bank that you could think of wanting to buy, exchange these rubles at a very discounted price. And since we had a contract with the Russian Federation to be, which is now recreated from the evil empire, we had a good spread in our favor.
And all right.
So realize that. So they were our initial banker in Singapore.
So I'm not sure about the timing here, but at what point are you falsely imprisoned in Switzerland?
Well, it's very funny because I got a call from Melanie Vernier from the White House. She worked for the White House, and she asked me to meet Vince Foster, which we did, in Switzerland, and he wanted me to stay with him at the Toll Health Hotel Delapay.
And Vince by the way, Lee, let him know what Vince Foster is. Who was Vince Foster?
Vince Foster was a White House counsel, number one White House counsel. He was going to be the collector of the money that they needed for the Children's Defense Fund, which is $250 million. And since I thought that was a great idea, so we on his American Express card, he had appointments for us at Hotel Delapay, so I could give him $250 million from credit card, which I had. That was not a problem.
He asked you, just so people understand, excuse me, Lee, so people understand, you're in Switzerland. Now, this is during the Clinton administration. Obviously, years have passed. Reagan no longer in office. You're in Switzerland. And Vince Foster, White House counsel for the Clintons, is sent as an emissary over to Switzerland to collect a donation to the Clinton Children's Defense Fund in the amount of $250 million.
Yeah,
correct?
That's right. And I thought it was a good deal.
Well, because you thought it was a good thing to do. You wanted to donate to this charitable fund. Right.
Right. Well, any reservation, just get your $250 million and help the children.
Okay. So, but before you can meet Vince Foster to do that, what happened?
I had to go to Credit Scott Bank to send the money, which I had, to another bank, which was Credit Suisse in Switzerland. So they did the transfer to Vince Foster at Hotel Delapay. We were at another hotel in the area, so we were off. Vince Foster had arrangements for Ambassador Cheryl and myself to come to Hotel Delapay, and the money was sent to him. But on the way checking out at the other hotel in Switzerland, we had breakfast, and while we were at breakfast there, the Swiss Sûreté comes and arrested me, and they wanted to know what I was doing and where I was going. And I said, I'm not going anywhere. Why should I tell them anything? I'm an ambassador. They don't need to know what I'm doing. And the Swiss, and I also had a home, a big mansion we bought there, because I'm also the ambassador of Somalia to Switzerland. And Giovanni Ferro was with me, Ambassador Ferro. He was the ambassador for Somalia.
Okay, we're coming up on the top of the hour. I've got to interject here. So you have diplomatic immunity as an ambassador, and yet you are thrown into essentially a dungeon in Switzerland. And we'll find out what happens from there on the other side. Lee Wanta, President Reagan's secret agent, the man who masterminded a way to take down the economy of the Soviet Union and the Cold War without firing a shot. His spokesperson, Lon Gibby from Gibby Media Group, is also with us. Back on the other side with more of this incredible Ian Fleming-esque tale. Here's Brother LZ taking us into the break with Fast Train right here on Coast to Coast AM.